cover today some of the topics that come up in the mysterious twilight zone of the fourth Aliyah of Parshas Shoftim. And instead of going pasuk by pasuk, we'll talk about it just as a whole, because there is one major theme. As the Aliyah talks about the set of prohibitions which are identified with witchcraft, with magic, and the like. And there's a lot of halachic implications and a lot of hashkafic implications and practical hashkafic implications. So we'll try to consider a little bit what is the overall message and what are some of the specifics about this concept that emerged from this Aliyah, and we'll see how much we can cover in the time that we have. So we'll begin by going to the end. So one reason not to go pasuk by pasuk. Let's look at the last pasuk in the Aliyah, which is a little bit of a general statement, which might be relevant to the whole thing. The Aliyah ends with a pasuk, Tamim tiyei Hashem Elokecha, and you shall be perfect. So you might say, already I'm in trouble, right? Nobody's perfect. So what does it mean, a mitzvah, to be perfect? So that's a good question. We also have to figure out if it is a mitzvah. Tamim is a word that you find in Chumash a number of times. It's used to describe some of the great tzaddikim, or possible tzaddikim. And Noach has the poor luck that he's described as a tamim, and yet there's always a machlokas about how much of a tzaddik he is or was. Avraham Avinu is better. He's also described as tamim. So there is a notion of somebody who walks with perfection with God. So the idea of tamim doesn't mean perfection in the sense you don't do anything wrong, but it's more a sense of an exclusive relationship. And that seems to be the theme of this Aliyah, that one shouldn't say that, okay, I'll worship God, but I'll also hedge my bets. Meaning that we're not talking about outright avodah zarah, although it's not unrelated, that we understand that God wants us to worship Him and not to worship other gods. But maybe you'll also say, okay, I'll worship God, and I won't worship other gods, but who knows what other factors there are out there, what other powers there are, so I'll do the mitzvos, and I'll also try to hedge my bets by also trying to satisfy all the forces of black magic that are out there in the world by trying to also be prepared to be consistent with their demands as well. So to that, the Torah says, nothing doing. Tamim tiyei Hashem Elokecha, that your faith should be with God, and it should be perfect, it should be complete and exclusive. That's the relationship. So maybe to give a little synergy, you know, we always like to try to find overlapping topics between the Parsha and our Perek and anything else that comes up, a Yantiv. So here you might say also, if your future wife, God willing, asks you to be Tamim, she's not demanding perfection, she's asking for exclusivity, like the theme of Maseches Ksubos is to some extent. So the tamimus here doesn't mean you should be perfect. It means that you should not try to hedge your bet and say, I'm committed to God, but I'll also try to factor in all the other beliefs that are out there and try to live this two-tiered life. So says the Torah, that's not the way to be. So is this a mitzvah? So it's not clear. The Rambam does not count it as a mitzvah. And the Rambam, when talking about this, so the Gemara, Maseches Pesachim and Daf Kufi Gimel, the Gemara says, how do you know that you shouldn't consult with the astrologers, which the Gemara calls the Chaldoim, which is a nation that engaged in these practices? How do you know that you shouldn't consult them? Because the Torah says, Tamim Tiyei Hashem Elokecha. So the Rambam reads that, basically, it sounds like the way the Rambam understands that, is that that's not so much a mitzvah per se, as that is a statement of fact, that the Torah is telling you that you should only have a relationship with God, because everything else out there is bogus. This is basically the Rambam's understanding, that everything else that's going on with the astrology and with the horoscopes and with the magic and with the black forces of whatever you want to call it, so that's all hocus pocus, and therefore it's wrong, it's silly for you to get involved. That shouldn't be something that you should do. And instead, you're told, Tamim tiyei Hashem Elokecha. So there's a little room to wonder, so does the Rambam see this as a matter of Issa v'Heter, Or is he basically saying that it just doesn't make sense and the Torah is warning you against it because it's not in keeping with the wisdom of the Jewish people to try to be involved with things like this? So his premise was part of the machlokis he had with the other Rishonim, because the Ramban disagrees. The Ramban adds in the Sefer HaMitzvos, he has a hosafa. He says that the Rambam left out a mitzvah here, that there is a mitzvah to be tamim, and that means that there is a prohibition to consult these other sources, that it's wrong, it's not just a bad idea. And maybe it's not such a bad idea in terms of its efficacy, in terms of whether it would work, because maybe there is something to it. But nonetheless, that's not the relationship God wants you to have with Him. But it could be that there are such forces in the world. Maybe it's not all hocus pocus. But nonetheless, that's not for you. That God says, you stick with me, and you shouldn't be involved with these things. So therefore, that constitutes an isser, essentially, to consult with these possibly correct authorities, but experts, but it's not for you. And this is an important question, practically speaking. Is the Rambam just saying that it's meaningless and it's silly? Or is there really an isser involved? When the Gemara says that you shouldn't consult these people, is the Gemara telling you this itself constitutes a prohibition? Or is it saying that it's meaningless? There is a fascinating tshuva of Moshe Sternbach has in the Tshuva Svan Hagos, which I don't know if it really reflects the way everyone would understand. He discusses that maybe there is a tzad to consult with these fortune tellers, that maybe if your attitude is that, okay, because I'm a religious Jew, so the Torah is my lot instead, and I am able to cleave to God, and that Torah mitzvot will take me away from whatever fate the forces of magic have in store for me, so maybe it's kedai for me to consult what I would otherwise be subject to through the astrological forces or black magic or whatever it is, and then I'll be even more inspired to cleave closer to Torah so that it should take me past this force. So that's an interesting perspective. It goes a little bit to this question. Are you saying that there is some mamashus, but that's not for us, and that maybe you could find some inspiration to stick with the Torah because you see what the alternative is? Or do you think the whole thing is a joke to begin with, and therefore it's not something that even makes sense to consult on any level? So it sounds like that's a little bit of the question here. It's surprising with Schoenbach's attitude with Nassim Gestetner, who the veterans will know, I mention him often, I think it's the first time this year, that he was a great posek in Bnei Brak, who passed away a few years ago. So he has a few tshuvas about this in his tshuvas Lahoras Nassim, and he emphasized the position. He thinks that it's an isser, he thinks it's a prohibition, or a mitzvah saseh, rather, a mitzvah not to do this, not to consult these forces. Hi.
Does he get that from this pasuk of
Well, the whole context, right, we're working backwards here, went from the last pasuk, but the introduction of the whole setting seems to be that the Torah is saying that this is the way you're supposed to act, especially in Eretz Yisrael, and that there are other populations there that are living a whole different type of life and a whole different kind of relationship with who knows what kind of forces and what kind of influences, and that's not for you. You shouldn't be a part of that. There is also, as the Torah writes, that being involved with these practices is also, you know, kind of on a different track, it's also a violation of Chukosei and Lose Leif. The Menches Chinuch writes that he thinks that that means specifically if you do something, not just consulting, but actually doing, but it also reflects in a kind of another subtext to this Aliyah. This Aliyah kind of telling us two tracks, that there's all these forces that don't make sense and that's not for you, and it also has the stigma of being the Chukas HaOvdei Avodah Zarah, or is that really the whole thrust, that really the Torah is saying that because this is what the Ovdei Avodah Zarah do, it kind of defines the difference between the Am Kadosh and the idolatrous nations, and this is what they do and here's what you do, and whether or not there's any wisdom to it is not the point, but this is your path. Rabbeinu Yonah also in Shari Tshuva seems to understand that this is a isser to consult, and he has a raya from a well-known Gemara in Maseches Brachos, the first pack of Brachos in Daf Yud. So there is a Gemara that tells the whole story about the King Chizkiyahu and the prophet Yishayahu, that they came to meet. Gemara tells the whole background that it was necessary for them to talk, and neither one wanted to go to the other. question whether the Navi should go to the king, or the king should go to the Navi. The poskim quote this Gemara as far as the halachas of kavod and other contexts. But what we're interested in is the later part of the Gemara. So the Gemara says that somehow it worked out that they got to speak because Chizkiyahu took sick, and then Yeshayahu went to come visit him. So when he visits him, so he tells him what's wrong. He tells him why he's in trouble. He's in trouble because he was mevatel the mitzvah of Puruvu. He decided not to have children. So Chizkiyahu said, I decided not to have children because I saw that through the telling of the future that the children I would have would not be good people. They would not be a credit to society. So I decided not to have children. So their response, Yeshayahu tells him, says, Bahadei kavshi derachmana lamalucha. God's secrets are not your business. It's not up to you to worry about the inner workings of the world and how the future is going to unfold. My demiftilcha ischa lemeva, that which is commanded to you, you have a mitzvah perugu, so you should fulfill your mitzvos. It's not your job to say, well, I see through my prophecy that this is going to happen, it's not going to work out well, so I'm not going to do it. That's God's job. Hi.
It seems like that Gemara is limited to when a mitzvah and his understanding of a vision or whatever collide.
Oh, excellent point. So that is what some Achronim discuss. So the aforementioned Chubas Laharis Nasan, with Nasan Gishtetta, makes that point. He says, is this Gemara really so compelling? And just parenthetically, this Gemara comes up all the time because it's quoted in the context of questions about having children in general, about the calculations people make about having children. It's quoted for other reasons. This Gemara comes up in a lot of halachic discussions. Fascinating story, the whole about, you know, to what extent can we try to assess the future based on our perception of what's going on now. There's a lot of impact for this Gemara. So here, this point, so Arya's point is well taken, that maybe the Gemara is not making a blanket criticism against any consulting of fortune tellers of the future or any type of trying to look into what's coming up ahead of us. It's specifically because he was mevatel a mitzvah, because he said, I'll opt out of Puruvu. And if it hadn't been about that, so then maybe you wouldn't have such a problem. So he then goes on to note,
he's a Navi, right? So surely his prophecy is not considered witchcraft.
Right, also astrology. True. So, book said Yeshayahu was a Navi. The Ruach HaKodesh is a little bit different for, the Nevuah is a different kind of level, but in any event, so he points to the comment of Rav Yonah and Aibshus in the Sefer Yaros Tvash. Rav Yonah and Aibshus understands that Bukhara, this machlokes, there's a little bit more to it. That maybe he's got a good point, that if he's saying that I'm telling you that my children are really going to be bad, it's going to be a problem for the world, it's not going to be a contribution to the settlement of the world, so then maybe he's got a good point. Maybe that should affect, and the poskim do talk about that, maybe that should affect the mitzvah of Puruvu. So his point is that, no, that the issue is not so much his halachic conclusion. The issue is his belief that that had to be the future, that he didn't have a path to change it, that he should have thought that if he had stuck with greater commitment to Torah mitzvahs, you know, he was a big tzaddik, he did a lot of wonderful things. But if he had believed this was a lack, as far as this one prat, of Tamim Tiyah V'Shem Elokecha, that if he had believed that there was potential for him to change this prediction for what would happen, so then he would have come to a different conclusion. So the conclusion, as much as it impacted on a mitzvah, but the conclusion was the result, it wasn't the actual action. What did he do wrong? What he did wrong was the initial assessment that this had to be the future. If that was really cut in stone, that that had to be the future, okay, then maybe we could talk about whether that was a reasonable halachic conclusion. But it was the initial assessment that led him astray, and that's what he thinks is the source for this idea that Rabbeinu Yonah and others build on from this Gemara, that there is an Isser B'Davar.
Doesn't the Gemara show the opposite? That was Yeshayahu's attitude, that this was already,
Gzeira in terms of his dying. I mean, Right. But you're right. It's interesting points, but to think about that is as far as if there is a Kadosh Baruch Hu, that, you know, what the rules are for what change and what doesn't change, that's it's an interesting contrast. It's worth mentioning, but that was what he was talking about. But as far as his belief in his future telling, so that he shouldn't have been so committed to, and that's how Rav Yonah Sanayipshus understands it, that that was the flaw, that he was believing in that. And then the secondary result is that he also skipped out in the mitzvah because of it, and that led to all kinds of problems. So in any event, so there is a discussion about this, about whether this is a mitzvah or whether it's something else. Does the Ramban clearly does see it as a mitzvah saseh, he lists it as one. And the Rambam, who doesn't, maybe that's because he sees this more as a statement of reality rather than an actual mitzvah specifically. Or some understand that he just doesn't count it for a different reason, because he kind of sees this as the closing pasuk of this aliyah, that this is the theme of all of these mitzvahs, all the lo saseis that we find in this aliyah, telling us what not to do. So the slogan or the way to sum it all up is, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. Tamim tiyeh b'shem elokecha. So the Rambam doesn't maybe feel a need to count that as a specific mitzvah, because it's essentially just a positive restatement to refer back to all the isurim that you find in this aliyah. But what's underneath this whole story is clearly a machlokas about whether or not there really is such a thing as magic. Do you believe in magic or not? Does magic really exist? Or is it all fakerai? Is it all hocus pocus? So here the Rambam is saying that it's all nothing, and that's why it's wrong for a wise nation to be involved. And the Ramban wasn't assuming that way. And the truth is, other Rishonim also took issue with this. Other Rishonim, such as the Nimuki Yosef in his commentary to Sanhedrin, if you had a chance to see that. So the Nimuki Yosef also says that, no, it's not necessarily true that these things are all fake. There are more things in heaven and earth, Maimonides, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And it could be that there are things that we don't necessarily know about, we don't necessarily perceive. But maybe they do exist, maybe there are such powers. But still, the relationship that we're supposed to have with the Kadosh Baruch Hu is that we're supposed to believe it's not for us. And this was the view that the Ulm Gaon took as well. It's interesting. You know, the Rambam might say, okay, we're not surprised the Rambam's taking this position. The Rambam is known as a rationalist. That's generally his natiya, that he minimizes the more supernatural elements of the Gemara and the like. So maybe it's not so surprising, but it's interesting that Dav the Vilna Gaon, in his commentary to Shulchan Aruch, the Vilna Gaon says that just based on all the other Rishonim and a lot of statements in Chazal, which you would have to reread, you'd have to kind of reinterpret a lot of Gemaras with the Rambam's premise, although it's not out of the question to do that, and certainly the Rambam wasn't intimidated from doing that, but nonetheless, so the Vilna Gaon and others say there's so many statements in Chazal and in the Rishonim. So all the other Rishonim already clopped him over the head. It says, Kvarhiku al Kadkado, they already clopped him over the head, that this is not necessarily the conclusion. It just means that we're meant to stay away from it. The Rashba has a tshuva like this also. The Rashba also asks on the Rambam. And the Rashba ultimately says that he thinks that Tam Tiyah B'Shem Elokecha is an Azhara and an Avtacha, that it's an Isser and it's a promise, that it's basically God saying that, once again, stick with me and things will be better and don't get involved in all those other things, but it's not necessarily a statement that those other things are inefficacious. Maybe they do work, but that's not for you. Stick with me and it will be better. And then the Rashba takes pains to point out in this tshuva that the things that we see in the world that work, that have been tested, so we're obligated to pursue those. We shouldn't be so mechal hanes. You could easily misunderstand this. Right? You could easily think that, okay, so only stick with davening and mitzvos and the like for every problem and don't go to doctors. So the Rashba takes pains in this tshuva to point out that that's not true. We also say, ein som chanel hanes. And we have a pasuk in Parashas Mishpatim. The Torah says, verapo yirape. And the Gemara understands from that, mikan shiesh rishus lerofe lerapos, that we see there is permission for the doctor to heal. So we usually say more than that. We say there's a mitzvah for the doctor to heal. There's a mitzvah for the doctor to do what he can to help people. So the whole language the Gemara has in Bava Kamma of Rishus L'Rofe L'Rapos, that there is permission for the doctor to heal. So the Rishonim have a lot of different explanations what that is. Is it because you might think that you're countering God's plan? God expects him to be sick. God made him sick, so you shouldn't try to fix him. So the Gemara is saying, no, that's not true. It's God's problem, but again, your problem is that you should try to do what you can to help. Others say it's because of Choshen Mishpat considerations. You might say, what right do I have to be a surgeon to cut somebody up? Maybe I'll do more damage. Maybe he'll have a tiny against me. So I need a heter in order to be engaged in types of refuah like that. But it's also possibly, as the Rashba is saying here, that you might take this idea too far and you might say, okay, Talmud Tiyah Meshem Elokecha means don't get involved in any type of real world considerations of the physical world. Just daven and learn and everything will be okay. So they're not saying that. I'm saying that all these mystical forces, whether they work or not, that's not for you. But things that we can see in the real world, how they work, and they've been tested, so then that's something that you're obligated to pursue. And it would be wrong to be so mechal hanes and say that I'm not going to pursue these things. That would also be a wrong halachic attitude. And of course, the Rambam, we know the Rambam was a doctor himself, but the Rambam also writes in Mor Nevuchim that he says sometimes, again, he has to interpret a lot of Gemaras and a lot of historical statements in ways that are consistent with his shita. So he said that sometimes you find cases in the Gemara and the like where people are doing things that seem pretty mystical or seem pretty magical as far as what they're trying to do for purposes of healing. So the Rambam writes, he thinks that those things, even if they sound funny to us, they were things that were perceived as medicine. They were perceived as things that worked and that were tested, and it looked like they are normal processes of medicine. So even if they strike us as being a little superstitious, that's not necessarily the perception at that time, and therefore it's really in a category of normal medical pursuits. Hi.
Would the Rambam also say the same thing about sources within the Torah itself, like by Mitzrayim and things like that, where you see Torah says there is some type of magic that happened?
Right, so it's a good question in terms of, let's say, the Chartumim.
Yeah.
Right, so there are, you know, it depends what. Everything gets its own discussion a little bit, because clearly we believe in Nisim, that we believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will change nature on behalf of Klal Yisrael. That's a big foundation of our religion. So there's no question that, you know, that's supernatural. But the Rambam's tendency is that things outside of God's direct behavior is more rationally explained. So you do find some things, and sometimes him and other Rishonim sometimes say that things that we perceive as being outside of Teva maybe really are within Teva, and sometimes they were people having illusions rather than things that actually happened. You know, some of the Rishonim discuss what the whole story was with Bilam's donkey. Was it really talking? Did it look like it was talking? So you have trends like that sometimes in Rishonim to minimize anything that is outside of rational explanation. And again, not to include the Nisim, which are clearly in that category. But also, when it comes to Nisim also, we do have an attitude that we want to be mimayit the Nisim. We want to assume that Nisim are there when they're necessary. You know, Kadosh Baruch Hu does Nisim for us because that's his hashgacha, and that's when it's required. But if there isn't a big tzorech for an ace, so we also sometimes have an attitude that if something could be explained with a non-nace explanation, sometimes that's preferable. If it's not something like Tzias Mitzrayim, something like that's whole premise is based on it being miraculous. Okay, so this is a whole discussion how exactly we should understand this magical idea. It connects to a few other things. It's interesting, the Gemara in Sanhedrin also has the machlokas. It's hard to explain based on the drasha the Gemara has there, but whether the drasha tells us anything about it or not, but the Gemara has the machlokas whether maybe Bnei Noach are prohibited in Kishuf as well. So that goes to the question, again, is this something which is just worthless, or is it something which Davka defines the Jewish relationship, and that therefore the Torah is saying that it could exist, but it's not for you. The Gemara over there in Sanhedrin also has a statement about this whole concept, the whole word the Torah uses here of kishuf. So the Gemara talks about what the phrase means. Where exactly do you get this word kishuf from? So the Gemara suggests, it's the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that it comes from the word mechashin famalia shomala. So what does that mean, mechashin famalia shomala? That the Rivash has a tshuva where he asks how exactly you translate that. That it could mean two things. It could translate it as it contradicts the heavenly host, the heavenly design, that God has a plan and you are going against it. God says the world should work this way and you are pursuing a different path. Or it could mean to lessen We find in Hebrew, we find both words, that chachashak means to contradict, chachash also means weak. So it means that you're somehow trying to go against the heavenly plan, either by weakening it through trying to pursue other paths or trying to go against it. So that's itself a whole question. We also have a discussion. The Rama quotes the possibility of using Shemos HaKadoshim, of using the divine name to affect certain things, like we have the tradition that Moshe Rabbeinu killed the Mitzri with the Shemos Kodesh. So what about that? Isn't that also invoking mystical forces? Why does the Rama allow that? The Chasam Sofer has a tshuva about that, that isn't that also in the sense of contradicting or weakening God's plan? You're saying, okay, here's the way God's running the world, and yeah, you're going to try to invoke forces to try to contradict that. So the Chasam Sofer quotes from the Maharal that, first of all, as others say also, that if the whole idea is that you are looking to forces other than God, so if you're using tools of Kedusha, so maybe that's not considered looking to other forces. It's kind of an extra mystical way of doing it, but it doesn't necessarily have the same root, doesn't necessarily have the same premise of turning to black magic and the like. And also, it could be that the way the Mekubalim will understand, that the Shemos Hashem, that is God's plan on a deeper level. This is the Teva in a way that we don't necessarily perceive it, how the whole world is created through the Torah, created through divine word. So the ability to tap into that, this is beyond all of us, but to whatever extent you can relate to that, to whatever extent you can connect to that, maybe that's not necessarily an issue that shares anything in common with these attitudes. So that's a debate. There are those who are more into this, those who are less into this. Again, it also goes a little bit to a question of just what our tafkid is. You know, there are those who will feel that even if this is effective and even if this is a Jewish type of mysticism, that still, so our mitzvos are to follow the Torah and to do what we're commanded. It's not our job to be involved in efforts like this. That's a little bit of a philosophical debate, and that's kind of an ongoing question. So let's try just to talk about some of the concepts that are also included here in the Aliyah. So first of all, we'll talk for a few minutes about Nechush. So Nechush is a fascinating concept. Nechush in modern Hebrew means to guess. If someone says, I have no clue, I can't guess, they'll say, Yefshar Menachesh, I can't guess what's going on. But in halachic usage here, so it means something a little different. It really correlates to superstition. It means that if you base your behaviors on something which doesn't really have any basis, which doesn't really have any rational basis, so then that's nechesh. So if you say, I'm not sure whether I should sell my stock or buy more stock, and if a bird flies over my head now, I'll sell my stock. And if a black cat walks past me, I'll buy more stock. So that's an example of nechesh. It really correlates to what we often find in terms of superstitious belief, to say that something that has no relevance to anything, that's going to influence how, or it's going to really dictate, rather we'll call it that, how I'm going to make my decisions. So that's a violation of nechesh. So there is a very striking Gemara in Maseches Chulin, which was the topic of a big Machlokes HaRishonim, that the Gemara gives as an apparent example, and even the standard for Nechush, somebody who we shouldn't speak badly about, somebody who we should be very grateful to, because he's responsible for all of us being here today. Who's that? Eliezer Eved Avram. He did a tremendous tova for us, that he made a shidduch with our great-grandparents. He found the shidduch for Yitzchak, and he set up a test to do that, and it was very successful. He's looking for a balas chesed, and he found the balas chesed, the person who was going to feed all his camels, give water to the camels, and then to give water to him. This was a balas chesed, that's what he was looking for, and thank God it worked out. So all of Klal Yisrael comes from that decision. So it's a little bit surprising that you find really two statements in the Gemara that kind of criticize him. It's the Gemara Maseches Tainis, if you were learning at Daf Yomi a few months ago. So the Gemara says that Eliezer was an example of one who was B.K. Shalok Ahogun. that he asked inappropriately. He asked in a way that wasn't really right, and he's lucky it worked out, that the answer he got was better than the question. He was answered well, even though he didn't ask appropriately. And this Gemara Maseches Chulin, the Gemara holds him up as an example of Nechush. So that's surprising for a couple of reasons. One is that it seems insulting to Eliezer. So why is that a problem? Because first of all, even if you want to say that Eliezer wasn't Jewish, so maybe he shouldn't be bound by the prohibition of Nechush. So first of all, as we just mentioned, there is an opinion in the Gemara that Bnei Noach are obligated to observe these prohibitions. But also we have an attitude, Rashi and Chumash quotes, that Eliezer kept all the practices of Avram. He kept all the practices of his master. So to say that Eliezer was engaging in Nechush is a little bit hard to understand. But on a more fundamental level, even if we're willing to throw Eliezer under the bus, but it makes sense. Sorry? It correlates, right? This would not seem to be the definition of Nechush. Nechush, by its very nature, should be something which is irrational. So to say, here, this is totally rational. Here he's saying he's looking for a balas chesed, which is a great thing to be looking for. And he picked a test of chesed to see who was going to live up to it. So why should this have anything to do with Nechush? So some of the Rishonim say Itaka does not. So in fact, this was a big machlokas. And the Rambam in Hilchos Avodas Kochavim, the Rambam says, you're not allowed to be involved in Nechush, and in giving examples of Nechush, he includes Eliezer Eved Avram. He says he's an example of what you can't do. And the Ravid gets upset, no big surprise, right? The Ravid says, what are you talking about? The Rambam's totally wrong. And he says he thinks he got confused by the Gemara. It's also a little offensive. He says that the Lashon of the Gemara threw him off, but he doesn't realize that what Eliezer did was mutter. It was totally okay. So what exactly is going on in that machlokas? It's an interesting question. The Kesef Mishnah over there writes that he thinks that the issue is this point that we mentioned a few minutes ago, whether Bnei Noach are prohibited in Kishuv. That maybe the Rambam holds that Bnei Noach are allowed to do Kishuv. So therefore, Eliezer, he was okay, he could do it. But if we would do it, it would be wrong. It would be an aver against this parsha. While the Ravid held that it's also for Bnei Noach also, so therefore it must have been that Eliezer wouldn't have done it either, and therefore you have to assume what he did was okay, both for him and for us. The other Rishonim say differently. You don't have to necessarily assume that it was Nechush, but it was Mutter for him. And they give different explanations. Tosfos is a little difficult. Tosfos over there in Chulin, you can take a look. Tosfos defends Eliezer, but in a way that it's hard to know then what the Gemara is saying. Tosfos says that Eliezer didn't really decide based on that, that that was kind of the first step, and then later on he made the actual assessment that she was really the appropriate shidduch for him. But really going in an opposite direction, but also explaining the Ran as an important view, the Ravid sounds like he actually means this as well. The Ran says that the Gemara is not trying to tell us that Eliezer was in violation of Nechush. Eliezer was fine. Eliezer was rational. He was doing something which actually correlates. So in that case, it made sense. But the value of the Eliezer story is to teach us something else, that the Gemara is trying to say that in order to violate Nechush, you have to not only factor it in, but you have to completely rely on it. That if you take an attitude that you're going to decide your course of action completely based on this superstitious sign, completely based, you know, sell the stock only because the bird flew over your head, so then that's Nechush. So the Torah gives us an example of somebody who set a sign and relied on it completely to show us that that's the standard for Nechush. But it happens to be, in Eliezer's case, he was okay, not only because we trust in his integrity, but because it was a rational decision, so therefore it's okay. But if it happened to be irrational, Eliezer's level of commitment would be indicative of the level of commitment that you have to have in order to violate this issue. So the truth is, if we could say a minute of Musar and Drush from this point, that it's still interesting that Eliezer, either way, even according to the Rishonim, that defend him. So it's still a little bit bad luck for him It's a little bit unfair then that he's kind of held up as the poster boy for this Aveira, right? That if he did the right thing, so why should it be his mazel, so to speak, an ironic choice of words for this whole sugi here, and mazel Yisrael, but why should it be Eliezer's lot that if he did the right thing, he didn't do anything wrong, so why should the Gemara hold him up as the poster boy for the Aveira of Nechish, even if we'll say that it doesn't mean to really criticize him? So I think maybe there is a shtickle of criticism there, and I think maybe it's important mussar for us that, yes, in terms of the real issue of Nechish, this would not have been pure Nechish, because it was a rational correlation, that it wasn't a random connection between two irrelevant things. He was looking for something that actually correlated with the test that he set up. But this element that the other Rishonim pick up on, that he was absolutely committed to it, that is dangerous, and that is maybe wrong. And maybe that's what the Gemara in Tainus was saying at BK Shaloka Hogan, that reflects a certain mistaken way of thinking. And one could maybe suggest that this has to do a lot with the Isser Lashon Hara, an important topic for Elul. I guess all of Eris and Mitzvah is an important topic for Elul. But this is a very popular Aveira. So Lashon Hara, we always assume that it's a tough mitzvah to understand, that Lashon Hara is prohibited even if you're telling the truth. Right? What's so terrible about saying something true if it's negative? So perhaps this is a little bit of a clue as to what's so terrible. That the human mind has a tendency, the psychologists call this the fundamental attribution error, that we have a tendency to associate behaviors with qualities in a 100% connection. That if somebody does something, that's what he's about. If I do it, let's say it's a bad thing, if I do it, then it was an external force that prompted me. Normally I'm a good guy, I did a bad thing today because I was in a rush, or because I forgot, or because I've got a good excuse. But if somebody else does the bad thing, that's what he's about. This is his character. That's the way we tend to see the world. That everyone else, whatever they do, that is indicative of who they are. What we do, it's not so indicative. I have a good reason. But somebody else who does it, it's because that's all about them. So that's what they call the fundamental attribution error. And it's relevant here as well. That yes, it's true that if you're looking for a balas chesed, so a good place to start is to see if this opportunity for chesed would be taken up by her. That's reasonable, and that's appropriate. But to say that there's a 100% correlation between this act of chesed and people of chesed, that's a fallacy, that's a mistake. It could be that somebody would do this and not be a person of chesed. Maybe this was a one-time aberration or whatever it is, but every other act of life would not be so kind. And it could be the person is very much a person of chesed, but for whatever reason didn't want to do this. Maybe she's allergic to camels, or maybe she was busy with something else. You know, it could be that he would have missed out on a great shidduch because here she was the greatest balas chesed around, and for whatever reason she didn't pursue this opportunity. So to assume that there's a perfect correlation between this action and the midah that he was looking for, that's where there is a shtickel nefesh, that's where there is a shtickel mistake, and that even though it would be rational to say, okay, this is a big clue, I see she went and did this, she's definitely somebody I should look into more, so that would be okay, but to say this is it, that I'm looking for a balas chesed, so whoever does this is a bal chesed, and whoever doesn't is not, that's a mistaken way of thinking, and maybe that's what Chazal are picking up on a little bit. So maybe also just to reach that point, that maybe also that's why we have an Isser Lashon Hara, because even if you're saying the true thing, you're saying a person did such and such, and it's true, but it's very hard for us not to make the leap and say, okay, he did this, that's what he's all about. And it's not necessarily true. Maybe he did this, and it's not what he's all about. And you find this is at the root. I think this comes up all the time. Fights people have with each other and issues people have in marriage, it comes up all the time because you have a mentality, oh, if he was really a nice guy, he would do such and such. Oh, if she really loved me, she'd do such and such. And maybe not. Maybe he's really a nice guy, and for whatever other reason, he's not doing this. And maybe she really loves you, and still, she has a different reason to not do this. And our assumption that we can totally connect a person's character with whatever indicator that we're assigning, that's a nechesh in a sense. That's a type of irrational thinking, as much as it may correlate to something real. But to make it absolutely contingent on that, that could take you down a dangerous path, and then maybe that's what Chazal is telling us in this criticism. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know, kind of off topic. Isn't it similar to the way that Akash Baruch tested Avram, a very specific test to show that he was like so close to Akash Baruch, like let's say maybe he was showing that she was so good that even if she was ordering the camel, she would have come and done this class anyway.
You're asking a terrific question. It's a much longer discussion. I want to push you off totally. I do want to say a little bit more about this topic before we run out of time, but I'll just give you a little bit of indication of what's different about it, or what might be different about it. You know, maybe we get to say for Bracious, we'll have an opportunity to talk about to see where Ravi falls out in Vayera and the like. But actually, the Keda is Ravi. Right? Oh, yeah. So we'll have an opportunity to talk about that. So God willing, we will get back to that. But what a Nisayon means in the case of the Nisayonis of Avraham Avinu is a very important topic to discuss. God willing, if we do get to that, so there's a lot, I think, to differentiate between that type of nisayon and this type of a test that a human being will set up. The difference between God and humans is not irrelevant to the equation, but it's also just parenthetically, just to say this part very quickly, you may have heard the Vilna Gaon's comment that the point of having 10 tests, you know, that it's only after this last 10th test of the Akedah that God says, the angel says, you know, now I know that you are Yirei Elokim. What, 9 tests he didn't know? So yes, it could be that any one of them may be an aberration, or maybe that's just the way he is naturally, and it's not about Yiras Hashem and Estavka, because there were certain contradictory components within the test that he was able to take them all together. So there was a lot to pursue as far as that's concerned. It's a very valid question, and God willing, maybe we'll come back to that a little bit more in the context of the Nisyonis of Avraham Avinu and that issue as a whole. But just to say a few more words before Mincha, there's a few more important topics I'm going to try to squeeze in. So Nechush is a big discussion. I think that Moser Haskel about Eliezer is important, but there's a lot of other elements in terms of Nechush. First of all, also timely. So as we approach Rosh Hashanah, so there is a whole discussion about the difference between a siman and Nechush, that we do allow these Gemaras, and it's part of our practice on Rosh Hashanah night to have a concept of a siman, and to say that certain things are there and connect to having a good year. You know, apple and honey is the most common, but there's some have spent the whole night, Rosh Hashanah night, adding all kinds of different other simanim, and having all kinds of different other foods that are supposed to evoke positive ideas. You know, you take a raisin and you cut it in half and you put it next to a piece of celery and you say that you should have a raisin celery, right? Things like that. So what about that? Is that Nechush? So the Gemara says, Simona Milsa, so what does that mean? So you find also other kinds of things like this. The Gemara in Horia says that when they would appoint a new king, when they would anoint the new king, so they would do so by a river, and they'd say, just like the river is powerful and flows with strength, so too the reign of the king should be with strength. So some understand that Simon is different than Echish, and that it has a little bit of a correlation, but that probably the way the Meiri explains, and probably the way that it's most irrelevant, is that we're talking more about inspiration than about siman. It's not that you believe that if you do this, then everything will work out for you, nor is it about you're saying that, oh, this happened, I'll make my decisions based on this. It's that you want, when you're about to start something, let's say you're davening for a new year, you're about to start a new role as king, so you want to be inspired by symbols of power, by symbols of strength, by symbols of bracha. So to look for external cues of inspiration, of ways to visualize success and strength and growth, that's not the same thing as Nechush. And the poskim talk about this a lot. There's a number of tshuvas written about the fact that there are those who have a kepeda. It's interesting, it's brought in Shulchan Aruch. I think in Shulchan Aruch it comes up not where you'd expect it to, but this is also a little bit of a synergy. So we're talking about marriage and weddings. So there is a practice to have a wedding date scheduled only in the first half of the month. It's called Bemiloy Halavana, that when the moon is getting bigger, the moon is full in the middle of the month, so the first half of the month the moon is getting bigger, so that's when weddings should be scheduled. And the second half of the month, when the moon is getting smaller, Bechoser Halavana, that's not as good of a time for weddings. So what about that? Is that Nechush? So it's in Shulchan Aruch. I think the reference to this concept is not in Ibn Ezra. It's in Yerdeh explaining why it's not a violation, or posking that it's not necessarily a violation of Nechush, but clearly it raises our suspicions that maybe this is something that is not so appropriate. So here, the Tshuvas Yehudi Yaleh, Reb Yehuda Asad, a few others have Tshuvas about this, and they suggest that, again, the point is not that we think that your marriage is going to work out, Davka, because you got married in the first half of the month, and that people who get divorced should not blame their situation. They should say, oh, look to the day, though, if it was the second half of the month, that was what went wrong. No, it's not about that. It says that this is a symbol of inspiration, and that we like to look for anything that's going to put us in a positive mode, and this is something that does that. But together with that, so the post can discuss that, so let's say somebody plans his wedding, and he plans it for the second half of the month, and then he finds out about this idea of having it in the first half of the month. So now he wants to call up the caterer, forfeit his deposit, and reschedule, and the girl's not interested anymore, so he's going to have to marry a different girl if he's going to move it to a different date, and he's going to have to go back and saw you at Sinai, and the whole story, and it's going to take another couple years, and he's going to have to turn his life upside down in order to schedule the wedding in the first half of the month. So, is that appropriate? So the post can write that not only is that not what we require you to do, not only should you not go to such lengths in order to do that, but Davka, that's the point, that if somebody were to do that, then that's Nechush. That if you're going to say that I'm going to turn my life upside down in order to get this simin, so then that means you think that it really makes a difference. You think that that really connects to the success of your marriage or not, and you're putting all your faith in that, that would be Nechush. If all other things equal, and you can marry the same girl in the same year, in the same month, and everything is going to otherwise be comparable, okay, so we'd like to take the inspiration of the first half of the month rather than the second half of the month. I spoke about it at my own wedding. My own wedding was the Hanukkah time, which is the second part of the month, but the poskim say Hanukkah is also inspiring. So, that also has an element to it. I spoke about this at my tish. But the point being that this could be something that might be inspiring, but if you're going to put so much focus on it that you believe this is worth turning everything else upside down, that itself becomes an act of nefesh, and that makes it into something which is wrong. Hi.
This is just a comment. Do you know the book Faith and Folly from one of the Catalyst? So there's a story apparently, I think it was the Stiplers, guy came and said he lost his shidduch because she found out from some Catalyst that the names didn't match up or something in the Kabbalistic world, and the disciple got very upset and started crying.
And you could hear that. Yeah, which also goes back to the whole question of in terms of decisions. That's a long discussion, but I could definitely hear that. So just to say a few more words before I have to admit, and a few more points to get in. So what about, let's say, coin flipping? Making a goral, making a lottery of some kind to make a decision. So here, this presumably mutter, that if you make a coin flip, Sternbach has a truth about this, and others talk about this, that if you make a decision based on tossing a coin, so chances are, hopefully, that you don't really think that this is any simon of anything. You don't think that, oh, if the coin turns up heads, then it's a message to me that I'll be successful going this way. And if the coin turns up tails, it's a message the other way. You don't think that when you're flipping a coin. Basically, you don't want to make a decision. It's not worth your mental energy. So you want to essentially pick something random. So therefore, this is a way of making a random decision. So that doesn't necessarily carry with it any connotations that you think it's meaningful. From a psychological perspective, sometimes it's valuable because if you want to know deep down what you really want to do, so then you flip the coin and you see how you're disappointed. You're not disappointed. Sometimes you make decisions that way. You say, okay, heads I'll go, tails I'll stay, and then you see it turns up heads, then you're happy, you're disappointed, so then that shows you what you really want. But as far as thinking that it's any type of a mystical sign that you should do one thing or another, that's usually not the mindset that people have when they flip coins. And also, when you make a lottery, so again, the lottery is usually, let's say, in that context you have to give out something. So it's because you want a dafka to be random. It's because you don't want to be accused of favoritism or of anything like that. So you sometimes in life you dafka want a random decision. You use the lottery or the coin toss to be random. So that's the opposite of Nechesh. You're saying that this doesn't have any symbolism and you're using it specifically because it doesn't have symbolism. And that's presumably not a problem of Nechesh. It's interesting also, there is a concept called the Garul Hagra. And so that books, if you read it, Tzadik in Our Time, is a very fascinating story about the Garul Hagra. So Garul Hagra, which really predates the Gra, is associated with the Gra, but you find the indications of this in the Gemara already, that involves opening up a Chumash and system of how you find the Pasuk, whatever it is, but you open up a Chumash basically, and the Pasuk that you find somehow gives you a clue as to what you should do. So this, you really find in Chazal already, because the Gemaras talk about sometimes Gemaraim wanted to make a decision, and they would find a child who was learning in Yeshiva, who was learning the Chumash, and they'd say, "Psokli psokayich, tell me what pasuk you're learning today," and they would, that would be like opening up a Chumash. They didn't have printed Chumash, but you could ask a random kid what pasuk he's learning, and that's a way of just getting a pasuk thrown at you, so to speak. And that seems to be the predecessor of the Garul Hagra, or the idea that the Garul Hagra is based on. So there, the poskim assume also it's like Shemos HaKadoshim, that's not looking to some random force, but also it's a question how easily you should run to that. That's, I'm right, that this is okay when you mamish have nothing else to make a decision based on. But if you have rational factors which say that you should do one thing, and then still you decide to open up a chumash to get indication to do the opposite of the rational decision, that might also be a problem. You have really nothing else to go on, okay, so then maybe this is not considered something which is outside the scope of Torah and Kedusha. And again, just to say one more point about the Nechesh part, so the poskim do point out that, technically speaking, that the Isser, like we alluded to before, that to really violate the Isser of Nechesh, you'd have to totally rely on the sign that you're basing it on, and maybe you also have to say it out loud, and you have to explicitly connect what you're doing to this sign, so that's the pure glot violation of Nechesh. And less than that is factored in, would seem to be irrational, would seem to be like the Rambam wouldn't be too excited about that, but be an actual violation of the Yisr Nechesh that we read about here, it seems like you have to have complete reliance on the non-rational indicator and a complete superstitious commitment for it to factor into that. So that's one of the concepts. Hi.
Okay, maybe this isn't Nechesh necessarily, but in the category of black magic and all this kind of stuff. What about the various, specifically in Israel, there's a lot of like the red strings at the
Kohen. Yeah, they're highly controversial.
Kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right, so it sounds like, you know, the many feel, I'm not going to take an absolute stand, but many feel that that's alluded to already in the literature as Darchei HaMori, that that's something which is not really a part of our belief system. It does seem to be very hard to justify based on the values that are transmitted.
The red string, like specifically mentioned, like in the
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So it's unclear exactly how that became associated with. I don't know the whole history of how that became associated with religious people, but it's not something that we would recommend. You know, you have to again, you know, figure out what's on one side of the equation, what's not on the other side of the equation, but. Really, we believe that that our Torah mitzvos, Eman Eisek Benestaros, that which is a clear mitzvah and a clear directive, that's what we try to stick to. And everything else is really beyond us and quite possibly bordering on the idolatrous. And the Kli Chemda has a discussion where he says that, let's say, a certain skula, you have a refua, that's a skula. Now, the truth is that a skula, even if you have a refua purposes, maybe the serum that we're reading about in this aliyah, are not necessarily harbo yavo, right? They're lavs, they're lavan. So if you really had a belief that a certain magical practice would save your life, it was mamish pikuach nefesh, you know, it could be that kishuf is mutter. It sounds a little funny, and obviously the Rambam's going to say, what are you talking about? The whole thing's a joke anyway. But if you have a reason to believe that a kishuf would work, theoretically it's not harbo yavo, and you find that discussed in the poskim as well. So there is a discussion that Kli Chemda has, should you be Mechal Shabbos for a school or refuah to get better? So he writes that whether or not it's appropriate to use these types of skulas in general during the week, says, but the best skula is the mitzvah satara, that to be Shomer Shabbos is a better skula than any random thing somebody's going to tell you about. So if you're looking for extra spiritual points, you should be Mechal Shabbos for the physical needs. You have to go to the hospital to get an ambulance and all of that you should be Mechal Shabbos for. But to look for a skula and hope that's going to help you in Shemayim, it'll help you much more in Shemayim to keep the actual halacha and not forfeit that for the skula. Hi.
Have you ever heard the someone went to Rabbi Buchatera and said, are we not supposed to have nuts on Rosh Hashanah because it's gematria off by one to chet? And Rabbi Buchatera said, you could also not sin on Rosh Hashanah and it's not even off by one.
Right, that predates him. They attribute that to the Kutzker Rebbe. Okay. He said that ego is bigmatria chet and chet is also bigmatria chet. Sometimes. So. Sorry?
Not a real thing.
It depends what you mean by real, but you know the point is.
Isn't it found in how often the
version? Yeah, it's discussed, but the point is that his point is not so much not doing it, it's that forgetting that there are certain things which are more connected to issues on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur than that. So just we have only a few more minutes, I want to talk a little bit about Ma'onin. So Ma'onin, especially, have to get in for the synergy value. Because if you look at Rashi here in the Parsha, so Rashi explains that Ma'onin is from the word Ona, right? So we discussed earlier in the week that Ona, which we use to mean the obligation of the husband to the wife in terms of the physical relationship, but it's called Ona, which may be euphemistic, which may mean time, so maybe just a nicer way of saying it, but we also discussed it may mean literally time, but it may mean in general the husband has an obligation to spend time with his wife, and the physical part is just one aspect of it. So here, Rashi quotes here from the Gemara that Ma'onin comes from the word Ona, and that it has to do with fortune tellers telling you what's the time that's going to be most successful to do something. So this idea of time is built into this word Ma'onin. But in any event, so we find it used in the context also of trickery, of what you might call nowadays sleight of hand, that the Gemara calls it Achiza Seinayin, which seems to be the Talmudic parallel of sleight of hand. Sleight of hand focuses on the hand, and Achiza Seinayin is on the viewer. His eyes get grabbed, so to speak. That somebody whose hands move so quickly so that people can't see what's going on and they get fooled. So that is connected to Ma'onin. So it sounds like most of the Rishonim are going to understand that if you do real magic, so you're over a violation of Kishuv. If you do fake magic, you're over a violation of Ma'onin. So for the Rambam, we're going to have to figure out exactly what the distinction is. There may still be a distinction, but it seems like to create the impression that you're a fortune teller, the various other Isurim that you find in the Aliyah here, so many of them are talking about different forms of doing things like this, that if you use, the Pasuk refers and the Gemara explains, if you got a chance to do the Gemaras in Sanhedrin, so different ways people would do things like this, using animal parts, using different displays to try to create the impression that they could see the future or that they could pull off tricks. So that's an issue of Ma'onin. So there is a big discussion. So what about our contemporary magic shows? What about magicians who put on a show? So is that a violation of Ma'onin? So that was a big discussion. The Chachmas Adam has a whole thing that he saw people do this at weddings. That was one of the shtick people would do at a wedding. They would do kind of magic tricks. And he thought this is terrible. He thought this is a violation of Ma'onin. And that's also Gneivas Das. And that's basically deceptive. And it's wrong for a whole host of reasons. So that may be. In the 20th century, so later Poskim discussed the modern magicians that we have nowadays. So there is a big tzad l'hakel. There is a big tzad to say that the magicians who put on performances nowadays are not really in this category. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a non-committal tshuva about this. He has a tshuva that was printed in the journal, the Aguda journal, Am HaTorah. And for some reason, he didn't want to actually paskin. He said he wasn't asked l'maisa, so he's not going to conclude. And he says if he was asked l'maisa, he would try still not to answer for some reason. But he discusses there that it is possible to say, and many other poskim consider this as well, that nowadays the magicians, they're not interested in making you think that they can do magic. They're not lying to you. They're not. They're neither being Gonev Das, nor are they trying to create the impression that they actually do magic. And I think it's especially relevant that nowadays, what do they call themselves? Sorry?
Illusionists.
Illusionists, right? The illusionist means you are advertising the fact that you are performing an illusion, that what you're doing is not what it looks like. So what it is nowadays is it's really an intellectual game, basically. That David Copperfield, if you were to tell him that you're convinced he has magical powers, he'd be insulted, because he doesn't want you to think he has magical powers. He wants you to think that he's smarter than you are, right? That he discovered a way to make it look like something happened, and you can't figure out how he did it. But he doesn't want you to come to the conclusion that he taps into some mystical force. He wants you to be baffled by how smart he is, that he has figured out a way to do this, and you can't figure out how he's doing it. So it's essentially an intellectual challenge rather than an actual attempt to convince you that he's doing anything mystical. So that is a very significant sad l'hakel, that it's not a violation of this isser. Nowadays there are from magicians who have an approach that they reveal one trick, that they explain how they do their show, and they explain how they did one trick. So the idea being that despite the isser of magician never reveals a trick, so here they're more worried about the isser of the moaning. So the point being that they see that, okay, one of them was explained al pi derech hateva, so you know the rest are also able to be explained al pi derech hateva, and therefore it's not going to create this impression. There were some who were concerned that, okay, so maybe we should say that these magicians are acceptable only for adults who are going to realize that it's all a show. But a kid who may actually think that it's actually magic, so then maybe Lagabe the kids, you're violating the Isser of Ma'onin, which Rapp once pointed out, that would mean that the commercial is wrong, that the actual psak would be silly rabbit tricks aren't for kids, and tricks are only for grown-ups. But you could still say that, and you know, you have kids, you see this is true, that even very young children are more skeptical than adults. Even very young children, when they watch a magical show, they don't think that anything actually magical is happening. They also know that the grown-up, when you take the quarter out of their ear, they know also that you didn't actually summon up some demon and get him to take a quarter out of their ear, that they recognize also that you're pulling some kind of a trick, and that's what they're enjoying. So there is, I think, a strong tzad l'hakel to say, both for adults and for children, that you know, either they're too young to even know that you shouldn't be able to do what you're doing, or they're old enough to realize that it's some kind of a trick. So there is a big tzad l'hakel. Again, posts can go back and forth about this. There's many shuvas about it, the Dibur Yatziv, the Shevet Halevi, and the mentioned Rav Moshe, many printed shuvas about this that take all kinds of different approaches. But there is a strong tzad l'hakel that this is not what's addressed by this sister. Hi.
If their
ketamim
was a dead matter also for that, meaning first doing the magic is a gadol, first
right.
Doing the katan. So it's not like listening either for katan, or maybe it is.
Well, if the person is doing the wrong thing, then we would be worried about that. Now there
even
is a
even if he's doing the wrong thing for katan.
Right. Well, if he's doing it for himself, you know, the isser ma'onin really is on the person who's doing it, right? So if he's doing the wrong thing, then we could talk about it's all this funny kind of lifnei iver against yourself, so
right.
To speak. So, which you find some places in another context discussion about that, which is also an interesting question. But they do talk about this behavior in general with Yisurim of Kishuf in terms of consulting a Mechashev and the like. But it would seem to be contingent that if what the performer is doing is not wrong, then it's not wrong for the kids either. So, but you might say that if the Isser of Ma'onin means that you shouldn't try to fool people and think you're doing magic, so then probably it wouldn't matter who you're fooling. You're fooling grown-ups, kids, you're fooling somebody. That should be a problem. So it's a question, is your audience really fooled? So it's likely that nowadays when magicians do tricks, really nobody in the audience really thinks that they're doing anything mystical. And there is, again, I wouldn't say it's what everyone agrees to. It's a big machlokas in the post, there's a big discussion about it, but there is a big tzad l'hakel that's different than what's being described here. Hi.
There are some magicians who build up a persona that they are perhaps tapping into some mystical, like David Blaine or Chris Angel, or these types of people that are trying to like make it much more supernatural. So the question is, if you know as a person who's a fairly rational person that they're probably most likely not tapping into something like that. What is that saying? Where's that set?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's a little bit of a hashgafic issue more, you know, that whether that translates to an absolute issue for you, probably not. But is this something you want to support, you know, or is this somebody you want to bring in for your kid's birthday party? So I think it is clear that to try to create the impression that there is a force that you are connecting to is certainly against the hashkafa of this aliyah, whether or not it's a technical iser. So that create an absolute iser for you to participate? Not necessarily, but it, you know, from a hashkafic perspective, that's not something you necessarily want to support. And, you know, I don't think that's the kind of attitude you'd want to have at your kid's birthday party. You know, that's the kind of thing that would probably send the wrong message, whether or not it's a technical violation. But you certainly could make the case that it is a technical violation. If somebody really is trying to convince you that he is tapping into that, so it would seem like that is his classical moaning. Now, you would, the counter-argument probably would be that even that's a shtick. Even that, we know that nobody really buys it, and that's part of his act, part of the persona. So you can make a case that it's not an absolute issue. But again, ashkafically, I don't think this is the kind of thing that we want to be teaching or conveying. But when it's done more innocently, as is often the case, you know, that we know he's a performer, he calls himself an illusionist. It means you're saying right out, you know, you would think that that's itself already an instant head to somebody who calls himself an illusionist is advertising that he's not actually doing magic in his name. So that's probably a strong basis to say that it's a different kind of thing. So just to mention, we only have about 2 minutes left, but so there's also Chover Chover and Shol Ovi Yidoni, which seem to be different ways of trying to consult the dead. And the Gemara mentions, you know, let's say if somebody goes to a cemetery and starves himself so that he'll collapse into some type of faint, and then he hopes that the mason will communicate with him through this new state of mind. So that's a problem. And that's a question. Nowadays, people go to kvarim, so it's a whole discussion what type of attitude to have. Is that some way of trying to consult the dead in a way that should be problematic, or does that have a different type of mentality to it? You know, the idea of a melitz yosher, that we're asking that somebody in Shemayim should be mispalel on our behalf, so that's usually considered to be a different type of concept, although it is somewhat controversial. Nichas Elazar, Chassidish Rebbe, the Menkach Rebbe, he has a tshuva where he says one shouldn't think there's anything wrong with visiting Kibbutz Tzadikim, and that's a mitzvah, and that's a kibbutz aveim. But he was reflecting the fact that there were others who felt a little bit differently about it, or that it could theoretically send the wrong message. And that's also something that's a little bit difficult. And maybe we'll talk more closer to Rosh Hashanah, that there was a whole debate, Chassam Sofer and others were opposed to putting in our Rosh Hashanah davening, Machnisei Rachamim, the idea that we appeal to the angels and we say they should be the ones to bring our tefillos in. It's a little bit of a narrow hashkafic line, and it does involve certain issues. Just to end off by mentioning one other point the post can talk about this. So there is literature about hypnotism. Should we say that if somebody is hypnotized, is that a violation of Kishuv? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about this. And before him, 100 years earlier, there was a tshuva about in the Binyan Siyan, with Yaakov Ellinger, the Rebbe of Rav Shalom from Fal Hirsch, also the author of the Sefer Aruch Haner. So they both were makel on this, that in the days of the Binyan Siyan, it was called magnetism, which does not mean what we call magnetism today, but that's what it was referring to hypnotism. So they both understood that hypnotism is not a mystical trick, but that it's somehow a science. It involves connecting to the subconscious in a scientific way, and it's done under laboratory conditions by doctors who are licensed. So they both come to the conclusion that that's not a violation of Kishuf, and that it's Mutter L'shem Rufua. Rav Moshe goes on to say that specifically L'shem Rufua says you do have to worry that, and this is a question how much you have to worry about this, but he was concerned that if you're going for entertainment purposes, something like that, that maybe you have to worry that they're going to make you do something which is immoral, make you do something which is inappropriate, so it's not something to do casually. But as far as a real solid purpose or refuah and the like, so that he was in agreement with the view of the Binyan Siyan that this is a science and this is not a violation of the Kishuv imperative. Okay, there's more to say about this, but as we said, the mitzvahs of Torah take precedence, so we want to try to daven mincha with the tzibur, so we'll go to the Spanish for that. Again, God willing, on Sunday, we'll probably talk about something Yom Kippur related, and see you then. And you should have a wonderful Shabbos. It should be only good things. You should be perfect. You got it.
Shabbos.
Sorry?